Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. One thing we need today is we need people who can think big, who can engage with many different domains of technology, culture, design, consciousness, who can come up with inventive concepts, but who are also funny and incisive about the absurd marvels of our particular condition. And in that rather rare category, I would put our guest today, Jonathan Keats, who is a conceptual artist and equally an experimental philosopher. And, you know, it's usually I don't send people to Wikipedia for enjoyment so much as just for information. But in this particular case, I do urge folks to get around to checking out Jonathan's page on Wikipedia, because it is extremely thorough and rather amusingly written in a subtle way. But more to the point is that Jonathan's work is cool in the sense that just hearing what he did gives you a good dose of what the concepts are, what the event is. So it's not like, oh yeah, there was this great art show, you got to go check it out. While the objects themselves and the spaces are very interesting and very worthwhile, there's also something conceptual about them that you get a lot of information just by hearing some of the things that he's done, which gives you, in a sense, more of a sense about the nature of his work than just describing it abstractly. So I'm just going to pull out a couple of my favorites right now just to mention. At a gallery in San Francisco, he used string theory and applied it to real estate development. So he developed the idea of air rights, which is that in any given space there are these extra dimensions that string theory posits. So essentially it's kind of real estate, and you can buy it and trade it like any other kind of real estate. And to make it to sweeten the deal, he also designed blueprints for four-dimensional tesseract houses that purchases of these of this new form of real estate would perhaps like to implement on their new property. Another example, you know, showing his relationship with avant-garde tradition, he created a ringtone based on the famous John Cage composition, 4 minutes and 33 seconds. And if those of you not familiar with that piece, the piece is 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence, which Keats remixed into his own silent remix, which, as the Wikipedia page explains, stirred up folks in the classical music community and the world of technology, but really attracted some folks in the world of astrology. Keats's projects are very much designed to stir up interest and controversy and commentary by the you know, world press, and a lot of them have gotten a lot of buzz because of their cleverness. But what's great about them is that they're not just clever for cleverness's sake. They draw in some very interesting questions about society and science and technology and the future. I'll just mention one other one that I enjoy is in 2011, he gave New Yorkers the option to instead of getting married in the traditional form, to bind themselves together through a law of nature by using the principles of quantum entanglement. And so with stuff that he bought on eBay, Keats developed an entanglement engine that would entangle a couple who visited this institute in New York. But the sort of clever twist on it, or extra twist, is that when you get entangled, you have to kind of take it on faith, because the way the quantum entanglement works, and they use this for, you know, advanced cryptographic methods, is that any attempt to measure the quantum system will cause it to collapse and disentangle. So really the quantum marriage has to be, you can't be skeptical about it, because then it falls apart. So it's a beautiful metaphor, very entertaining, and I'm really looking forward to talking to Jonathan more about his work and his new book about Buckminster Fuller, You Belong to the Universe, which is quite a wild ride. Definitely the best thing I've and most helpful thing I've read about Fuller, not only about his work, but also about the design principles he's playing with it, the limitations of his approach, and the inspiration we can still draw from his kind of big thinking. So with no further ado, Jonathan, thanks for joining me on Expanding Mind.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be on the program.
Yeah, it's really good. You know, I didn't even mention all the religious stuff. We talk about religion a lot in this show, and I just have to, you know, throw out that you also made some pornography for God. You were looking at the Large Hadron Collider, which was beginning to replicate early Big Bang conditions, and you said, hey, you know, I think maybe this would stir God up to maybe make some new universes, because ours is, of course, ultimately doomed by cosmic expansion. So there's also a way in which your work dealing with design and technology in the future, you still have this sort of interesting relationship to religion and the kind of, you know, the sort of nebulous mysteries that still surround our smart scientific models of the universe.
Yes, I'm really very interested in all belief systems, both past and present and future as well. And understanding and thinking about religion seems essential to me, just as it is really important that we think deeply and skeptically about technology and about science. And especially in the United States, where religion holds such sway for such a large part of the population, essentially, that religion is science for such a large part of the population, I think that it's important to confront both the potential and also the limitations of religious thinking, and at the same time, because it is so polarizing, to use that as a sort of leverage to look at where we may have blind spots in terms of our supposedly enlightened thinking as a modern, scientifically informed populace.
Yeah, and you did that in this the Atheon, which is this the first temple devoted to the worship of science, and that, you know, again was done with the spirit of stirring up controversy, and I'm sure there was a lot of interesting debate around that. And I'd love to hear what of the responses you got to the Atheon were the most instructive or illuminating to you in terms of the discomfort it gave scientists because they're like, we're not religious, or the discomfort it gave religious people because, hey, this is the anathema to, or, you know, religious ideas of God. What were the responses that were the most sort of satisfyingly unusual or illuminating?
In general, I would say that scientists are less religious about science than fellow travelers, than those who are the lay audience and who don't take scientific discoveries with the sort of skepticism that's built into the scientific method. And so that sort of a project, and also an earlier project in which I was attempting to genetically engineer God as a means of trying to figure out phylogenetically how God might be classified, those projects have not only gotten relatively positive response from scientists, but often have resulted in collaboration with scientists. So in the case of attempting to genetically engineer God, I was actually working with some scientists, with a geneticist at UC Berkeley, and also with a microbiologist at the Catholic University of San Francisco. And on the other hand, I found that those who are within the religious community are somewhat less receptive, especially those in the religious community who want to lay claims to being scientific. For instance, the main proponents of intelligent design. In the case of my attempt to genetically engineer God, those were actually the people who were most infuriated and who spoke out against it in a piece, for instance, that Wired wrote about the project. And I think that the reason is that they, more than any of these others that I've mentioned, are trying to conflate two different approaches to knowing or understanding. I am myself not an atheist. I am, however, not religious. I am deeply agnostic. My my background is I grew up Jewish and have a Talmudic approach to everything in life, and that includes belief systems and the possibilities that those systems all hold. So what has been interesting is the way in which the most fundamentalist factions tend to be those that are least tolerant of these thought experiments that I undertake. I suspect that if Richard Dawkins got wind of what I was doing, I would get an earful as well, and it probably would sound an awful lot like some of the proponents of intelligent design, which I think is enlightening, given that the degree to which he and some of the others who have turned science into a sort of bludgeon against the religious are entering into a sort of fundamentalist phase that to me seems to be anti-scientific.
Yeah, so, it's hilarious. It's so obvious to some of us, Stan, you know, who know our history of religion and understand some of the philosophical problems with science. And what's amazing about it is that so many very intelligent people ascribe to that position, but they seem completely blinkered to what it looks like to people who are, you know, who are aware of the religious dynamics of, within science. It's really quite an amusing irony. And I'm actually happy to say that from where I sit, it seems like that the strong sort of attention to that form of atheism seems to be declining somewhat, and I'm more interested in a lot of the things that come in its wake, even from people who are still strongly atheists. Though you know, as you may know, this show is very much along your agnostic lines. I wanted to ask you a little bit about these thought experiments. When that's a great word for them, that even beyond most things that go as, I mean, these aren't exactly the golden years of conceptual art in a lot of ways, but a lot of work that gets made in that way, it's still sort of gallery-based in a more notable way than a lot of your stuff, even though you're using the gallery and even playing with it and coming up with new ways to play with the art system, including making money off of the art system in clever and interesting ways that further the idea. I'd like to hear a little bit more about, as you were getting into this notion of thought of art as a thought experiment, who was inspiring you? Like, what were you looking at? Were you looking at you know, thought experiments in physics? Were you thinking about, you know, Dada? Were you thinking about, you know, happenings in the 60s? I mean, what was kind of your inspiration for making these kinds of interventions, which have a very, even though they have very different topics, there's a very Jonathan Keats flavor from them from the beginning. So there's some kind of thing you tuned into early on when you started this work.
I appreciate that. I don't strive for consistency, but somehow it all seems to fit together in my head, so it's always gratifying to hear that others see some sort of resonances as well. But my background is not at all in art, and I never set out to be an artist, let alone a conceptual artist. I studied philosophy and found it incredibly enriching and incredibly frustrating both, doing so in academia, where philosophy was a great discipline, but at the same time ultimately resulted as a consequence of specialization in only a very few people able to talk with each other on increasingly arcane subjects. I studied analytic philosophy in particular, which is probably the most severe of all areas of philosophy in terms of just how hermetic it is. And my response to that was to remember as a child what made me interested in philosophy in the first place, which was a general curiosity about the world. And so seeking to continue to do philosophy, but recognizing that academia was not the place where I could do so in this naive way, I set out to take one of the core ideas I had picked up from philosophy, that of the thought experiment, and to bring it out into the world. And really, the only place that it fit was the art world, simply because while almost every other field, including not only philosophy but also the sciences, have become increasingly specialized, increasingly siloed, the art world has gone in the opposite direction from an academic approach in which you learned a certain technique of painting or sculpture to post-Duchampian anything goes sort of approaches where I could undertake the thought experiment, that is to say, to posit an alternate reality and to see how that might play out. I could do that in a way that, unlike as it was done in philosophy, where it was done to make a point or to make an argument, I could do it in an open-ended way. In other words, it becomes a sort of a combination of philosophy and perhaps science fiction, perhaps speculative design, as sometimes the visual equivalent of science fiction is now known. It became a way in which to posit alternate worlds, alternate realities that might be absurd, and the absurdity might lead to some sort of conversation around the world in which we live and the assumptions that we make that we might not otherwise be able to have, or that we might be so set in our ways that we might not be willing to have a conversation in the first place.
You mentioned science fiction. It's very satisfying because I find reading contemporary science fiction to be largely a chore. Partly because I'm an English major snob, and partly because I just don't really have the time for a lot of the material that's required to sell those things. I know other people love it, and I think it's great that people love it, but it's because mostly what I'm looking for is exactly what your work provides, you know. So in a way, you kind of like, I just can get the jewels, you know, without having to, you know, get involved in all these narratives. I can make my own narrative or understand the way that people are making their own narratives. I wanted to ask you about one piece that for me is particularly philosophically interesting, because one of the things that I'm into and one of the things we talk about on the show is this kind of, What are some of the consequences of a panpsychist view, or rather a view where we recognize that objects and living systems in particular in our environment have a certain kind of agency, a certain kind of consciousness, even perhaps in some sense they are persons, or what the indigenous would say have their own kind of non-human personhood. These are ideas that we play with, and so I was particularly attracted to some of the work you've done with plants. And the one that I'm thinking about now is the photosynthetic restaurant for some of the lucky plants at the Crocker Art Museum in Sacramento. Could you just talk about that one and maybe riff a little bit on this idea of, well, whatever, what kind of ways that people are how we're invited to reimagine our relationship with plants? And this is an absurd thing, a playful thing, but it's also a philosophical question.
Certainly. The project emerged out of the recognition that plants were spending an awful lot of time on our tables as gourmet cuisine. And yet, for plants, there really is no gourmet option. It's sunlight, and they take it as they get it. And it seemed to me that the meal, as humans experience it, is such a remarkable invention. It's one of the most beautiful and fulfilling things in my life, and I think one of the most significant things for us as a species. And so it led me to start thinking about whether I could provide plants with an equivalent experience, that is to say, to open a restaurant for them in which I would serve gourmet sunlight. And I wanted to be rigorous about it. I think that my philosophical training makes it such that I have to research as deeply as possible and to be as internally consistent as possible, even if externally whatever it is that I'm doing is absolutely absurd. So what I did was I looked at a body of research that had been done both by the Soviets looking to optimize growth of plants in greenhouses in Siberia, and also by NASA in the 1970s and 80s in particular, and subsequently to a lesser extent, for purposes of how you could potentially terraform for sake of interplanetary exploration. So they had figured out ways in which plants respond to different parts of the light spectrum, and that led me to realize that I could take classic cookbooks such as Julia Child and reverse engineer them in terms of understanding physiologically how those recipes were operating on us. And then I could go through all of the literature on different parts of the spectrum for plants, and I could map those parts of the spectrum onto ingredients and onto combinations of ingredients that we as humans savor, and therefore create this photosynthetic restaurant, which took the form of a series of colored panels that were erected in an old rose garden at the Crocker Art Museum, such that as the earth turned, it was like a great lazy Susan, and the sun would pass through one filter and then another, giving the plants this gourmet experience. And then, of course, for plants that couldn't be in Sacramento, which is the vast majority, I also made TV dinners in which I had a similar color combination that was broadcast on television on a public access station in New York City.
You know, one of the things I love about this is how much you, but in a very playful, accessible way, you know, sort of make a really interesting and sort of deep point about not only the kind of the aesthetics that go on inside the natural world, and really challenging the way in which, you know, in a conventional Darwinian approach, we say, okay, human beings have aesthetics, we have culture for whatever reason, maybe ultimately sociobiological, but, you know, we still enjoy opera, blah, blah, blah. But of course, the natural world, it's just purely driven by, you know, selection, et cetera, et cetera. And so, yeah, there's some pretty stuff, but it's really not directly about the lives of animals, or birds, or even or plants, and increasingly that's changing. So you're making an intervention on an argument that's actually, you know, out there in quote unquote real science about the role of aesthetics in animals and plants. And you've had you choreographed a wonderful ballet for honeybees by selectively planting flowers around the hives so that they would be drawn in certain kinds of ways and playing on that edge. But even farther, I think it's even more than this kind of scientific debate, which tends to be still rather abstract, is there's a generosity, humorous if in some sense, but still a kind of generosity in that you actually are trying to give the plants something, you know, have them have a good time. And there's a kind of sweetness in that that's also pointing to a much more profound question about how do we think about ourselves in relationship to all of these non-human others that we share the world with, which I think is an extremely important point, you know, philosophically, religiously, intellectually. So, you know, I was kind of curious whether that was also part of your interest, not just the kind of science of it, but the sort of action of generosity towards something that we normally think of as being inert and non-responsive.
I think that the science is very much secondary. It simply is a way of, it's a technique for being able to achieve this. And I approach it from inside the project with utter and complete sincerity to try to give the plants a truly gourmet experience. But I'm also not only a restaurateur for plants. I am also coming at this philosophically, and I would say that there are many different layers for me, one of which has to do with how we can look at ourselves and our own practices and our own relationship to the world by looking at something manifestly other, and plants are manifestly other, and we can use that as a way of seeing something that we do and then seeing it in a way that does not involve us, such that we can then look back upon ourselves and our own practices and start to ask why we do these things. Why does the meal matter so much, and what might be the consequences, for instance, this is a bit glib, but what might be the consequences of a fast food nation? How might that change us in terms of the cultural significance of slower processes by which we feed? To what extent is feeding not only what happens when we eat? So that's one part of it. Another part of it is what you're bringing up, which I think is certainly as interesting, and that is to say, how do we see these others? How do we understand ourselves relative to all of the other life on our planet? And we have a very long and rather horrific history of seeing ourselves as masters of a planet where everything else is merely produce, and plants in particular get classified as produce in any grocery store. So what happens when we take something that is manifestly ours and we bring it into their world? Then there is this process by which they're anthropomorphized, but I don't think it really is quite that. It isn't like I'm going around and putting aprons on them, or rather putting napkins on them and putting out plates and forks. I'm translating our world to theirs such that there is an easier transition, perhaps, between what we do and what they do, and therefore there's a more holistic sense of how all life on Earth has equivalencies and how this hierarchy, these superiorities, are somewhat questionable after all.
Yeah, it really reminds me of this Brazilian anthropologist, Viveiros de Castro, and he talks about what he calls Amerindian perspectivalism, so the kind of perspectival view that exists in Amazonian and other Amerindian cultures. And what he talks about is that the view is that from their side, animals are people too. So when that jaguar is, you know, tearing apart that animal and drinking its blood, for the jaguar, that's manioc beer. You know, and so when the plumage on the birds, for the bird's perspective, is a fancy costume for a night out.
Right.
So there's this very interesting way in which very other non-ordinary Western ways of thinking are suggested in these science fiction scenarios that to me are more than just questions of design, questions of science, questions of even throwing back our own human practices upon us, but really opening up in a genuine way to a larger world and a larger perspective, which is my sort of kludgy way of moving to the second half of the conversation, which is to talk about You Belong to the Universe, which is this new terrific book about Buckminster Fuller. And I just want to say once again that as somebody who's been around, you know, this sort of zone of utopian thinking and alternative thinking and countercultural thinking in the 20th century, you know, of course, Buckminster Fuller comes up over and over again. But I have to say, it was always a bit alienating to the point that I didn't really kind of wrestle with some of the ideas more as much as I should have. I kind of got a good sketch of it and then thought, well, I'll get to that at some point. In your short, very entertainingly written book, really introduced me to some deeper layers of his ideas and the practical consequences. And also, you were perfectly willing to be as harsh on him as he needs to be, in the sense that you're by no means an acolyte and are very clear about the ways in which he was an egoist and his ideas wouldn't work, and, you know, he was kind of a crank, and yet still seeing something very beautiful, sincere, and inspiring in his work. How long has sort of Bucky Fuller been sort of part of your imagination as someone who you could kind of, like, you know, recognize in some sense, resonance with your own interests in what you call comprehensive anticipatory design science?
I first got interested in Fuller back in the late 90s as Stanford University was acquiring his archive. And I think around the year 2000 or so, I wrote a very short piece for San Francisco Magazine on the acquisition of the archive and started to confront the Dymaxion chronophile, this insane idea that he had of saving absolutely every scrap of paper that passed through his life, and therefore positing himself as a guinea pig, as guinea pig B, as somebody whose life could be a means by which to understand how any life in the 20th century could be lived and what potential there was in that. And to me, that was truly fascinating and utterly unlike anything that I had come upon before. and also really resonated with me in terms of this idea of, as we were speaking about earlier, of the thought experiment and of taking on life in these sort of experimental terms. And so I ended up swallowing almost wholesale large parts of the myth that went along with that I'm actually a chronophile, a large part of what Buckminster Fuller constructed about his life through his many endless lectures and books, and found that to be, again, somehow deeply resonant in terms of the comprehensivism in his thinking. The thing that he called comprehensive anticipatory design science seemed to me to be very much something that I was striving to practice in my own work, and yet at the same time grappling with in terms of limitations that I was coming up against. And the more that I explored his work, the more that I found, first of all, that there were deep limitations in what he was doing, and also that there was a lot of fabrication that was going into the myth. And so writing this book, at a certain point, there is just a deep frustration with him, this sort of old elderly uncle who's always lying, who you just want to throttle. But on the other hand, I had to come to terms with the fact that that myth was what got me interested in the first place, and that what that myth was doing for him was essential to what he did for the world, which is to say, this way in which he synthesized so many ideas that otherwise had not been put together and made it such that people could understand at some level and grapple with those ideas at some level. So to me, the book became an essential project for me in terms of disentangling, on the one hand, this remarkable body of work and the thought that went into it, and at the same time, all of the deep flaws in it. Essentially, could I rescue Buckminster Fuller from his worst enemy, which I believe was Buckminster Fuller?
No, I can see that the challenge of that and the value of that, of taking that on. I mean, one of the nice things that you do is it's organized around different inventions or practices that Fuller developed. And you track his ideas and where they came from and some of the history behind them, and then also look forward to ways in which they inspire or anticipate and in some ways lay the ground for a very different approach that designers are doing today. So it's also a kind of a nice snapshot of some design contemporary design science that's sort of in a fuller mood. In a way, it doesn't really matter. I'd like to talk about one of these. I think that the geoscope is a really interesting idea. The kind of way in which he imagined, thinking about world order was really interesting. So what are some of the most important kind of elements, or even projects that he developed that kind of both anticipate and give us a sort of lesson in how not to design the future?
Well, certainly his three-wheel Dymaxion car falls into that category. He's famous for it. It was included in the show at the Whitney Museum in around 2008. It's a signature work that a lot of designers have embraced because it is such an incredible icon in this sort of retro-futurist way. And yet, it really is kind of a disaster when you start to look at what it did and did not do, and also where he went from some very profound ideas to some far more banal ideas as a result of living the life that he did in the way that he went about it. So to attempt to outline it briefly, the Dymaxion car is a three-wheel car that Fuller claimed could go incredibly fast on almost no gasoline and with incredible maneuverability as well. And most of this has not really borne out, especially the maneuverability has been always one of the great problems with the car. The reason why he developed it in the first place was that he was interested in shelter. He was interested in the problem of how to get past the slums that were essentially making cities into places where class was exacerbated and was ultimately deadly to a large part of the population. And so his way of thinking about it was that housing needed to be somehow mobile, that you needed to get out of the city to break free of that gridlock. And so he sketched out this idea in which his housing could be air-delivered by Zeppelin, classic Fuller thinking. A Zeppelin drops a bomb in the ground and then drops a pole and then drops a house on the pole and the house then hangs from the mast and it can be anywhere. So, interesting idea. Big problem. If it can be anywhere, how do you get from one to another, given that there's not going to be infrastructure, there aren't going to be roads necessarily? So, therefore, he thought that there needed to be some sort of a roadable aircraft and that this should be something that was very portable and that should use materials that certainly did not exist in his own time. So he had the idea of these inflatable wings. Well, since the materials didn't exist, he ultimately ended up building the taxiing system for it, and that was the Dymaxion car, which was never really meant to be a car but became one. And he got some funding for this and developed it enough that it almost became a real product. And the thing about it was that then he retrospectively went about this act of justifying what he had done. So it had three wheels largely because he had been working from the premise of an aircraft. But he suddenly brought in this argument about how fish and birds steer by their tails, which was not true, really, in the case of birds at least, and also which was not relevant because fish and birds are moving through one medium, through air or water, not on land through air. And so it was a very poor example of biomimesis or biomimicry. Yet at the same time, it was interesting for the fact that this was a relatively new way of thinking when he was talking about it. He later claimed that he was the first, but was not true. But nevertheless, it was an interesting way of thinking. To me, where we can go with this is to say that there's no reason to try to build Dymaxion cars today, even though Norman Foster has made one for himself as a luxury car. There's also no reason to think that we should break up cities and all live on houses on masts and basically create some sort of an Armageddon in terms of everybody having to fly by airplane to visit their closest friends. To me, what the interesting aspect of this is that he was more fundamentally engaging in biomimesis, not in terms of the fish and bird trick of how you steer the three-wheel car with a one wheel at the back, but rather this idea that you could think about how a civilization is built in terms of how, for instance, he spoke of wild ducks and the way in which their nests are not built on a grid, and that there's mobility in terms of their housing, that there's flexibility in terms of where they live. So to me, it's not about the fact that housing should be mobile or flexible, but rather about the fact that we can get away from slum thinking by thinking about the way in which birds live. Or in other words, biomimesis needs to be not in terms of a specific product, but in terms of a larger system. And so that's led me, in my own speculations, which are a large part of the book, to think about the way in which, for instance, we could organize democracy around the way in which slime molds self-organize and make decisions, in this sort of way in which you have this incremental decision-making from any given cell and this quorum sensing by which a community reaches a decision by consensus. So to me, it's a matter of trying to take that core idea and use it in ways that Fuller never would have condoned or even thought of, but to do so with direct inspiration from him.
Yeah, and one of the aspects of that that I find really, that was made the book really joyful for me, is that I think I'm in the the camp of someone who, in encountering Fuller in today's world, what are the things that I recognize is a certain kind of, you know, technocratic utopian envisioning of disruption as a way to produce this kind of technologically installed utopian solution to some existing problem that is very complex and full of inertia and full of mess, and that while the concept of using design in this kind of speculative way that's also has direct consequences for particular projects is wonderful, I've gotten increasingly sick of this tone because of the nature of contemporary techno-capitalism. And in your little comment just there, you talked about thinking about biomimicry not in terms of products, but in terms of systems, and the ways in which the openness required to really think systemically in a positive and productive way, in some sense, necessitates stepping away from the corporate model. And yet my impression, and I'm curious to hear your response, is that what we're seeing right now, I mean, Google's a great example, is that this zone of kind of speculative sci-fi, big picture thinking is now like kind of being absorbed into the protocols, the hype, the projects, the future disruptions of these enormous companies, making this whole kind of thinking a little bit harder to sort of take. And I don't want to be that way. I want to be inspired, and I was inspired by some of the stories you've told in your book about how, you know, actual designers and architects are using these things in ways that are not just about making a new product. But I'd love to hear a little bit from you about, whether inspired by Bucky or not, sort of reviving a kind of systems thinking that is not sort of simply driven by this kind of corporate agenda.
Fuller, in his own right, had a tendency to become autocratic. And I think that given that Fuller was essentially working for himself and was not a corporation, that it is instructive for how much worse that situation can become when you're talking about a corporate model that is driving some sort of a grand vision. Fuller had a tendency, he had a patent, more than one, on structures pertaining to the geodesic dome. And so he saw a geodesic dome as solution to every problem. And that put money in his pocket, which quite honorably he used mostly, if not entirely, for the sake of continuing to develop new ideas. In the case of a corporation, not only is there a tendency to think in terms of one's own intellectual property, because that is taken as a given, but also to do so for ends that cannot, by the very nature of a corporation, be for the betterment of the world as a whole. The betterment of the world as a whole might be a fringe benefit in the sense that it might be good marketing to make the world a better place, or it may make the may be the case that making the world a better place also makes your company more profitable to shareholders. And it also may be the fact that the CEO of the company is genuinely a good person and genuinely wants the world to be a better place. But the corporation exists for the purpose of making money for those who are shareholders. And so I think that you're absolutely right, and I write about this a little bit and probably should have written about it more in the book, about the ways in which the sort of thinking that Fuller engages in seems superficially to be equivalent to the moonshots that Google has proposed in terms of how we can combine the self-driving car with the Nest and various other systems for knowing the state of who's home at what time, and perhaps throwing in a little bit of some newfangled version of Google Glass, that by putting all that together, we can make for greater efficiencies in terms of how people use the roads and how energy gets allocated. A smart grid can be more efficient. But when it's done under the rubric of a corporation, it is always going to be for purposes that are not pure. And impurity may be the price that we pay for being able to survive in the current era of profligate waste in terms of the environment. But at the same time, we need to be deeply aware of that. And I think that by looking at Fuller in both the positive sense that he was operating totally outside of these sorts of systems, or not really, he was operating with these systems but doing so in a way that was somewhat disengaged, and also seeing how even in Fuller's case, these grand projects had a tendency to become technocratic and autocratic, that they can build in us a sort of skepticism that we need if we're going to come up with real world changing and redeem that cliche.
Yeah. No, and I think your work is, you know, a step towards that. We only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to talk about one thread that's very important to your work that in some sense gets back, and to the book, that in some sense gets back to the earlier part of the conversation where you were talking about your frustration with philosophy and analytic philosophy in the academy, and really a desire to keep thinking, you know, at a sophisticated, rigorous level about science and philosophy and other things, but to do so in new environments, because in a way, the specialization in the academy is kind of rotten. You know, it's locked in. It's not a good thing in a lot of ways. And this thread that you pick up in the book is about education, and you talk about education towards the end, and you also talk about the way Fuller taught and what was positive about the way he taught and what was very negative about the way he taught. So again, you know, maybe using him as an example, but thinking towards our situation now, you know, the rise of online universities. You have some very tart things to say about MOOCs and some really marvelous suggestions for ways we might move. So with the you know, 5 or 6 minutes left, I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about your vision of education and how, again, like Fuller kind of anticipated and also was an object lesson for what not to do.
One of Fuller's lesser-known projects was something that he called two-way TV. Essentially, he initially was thinking about how it might be possible for televisions not only to be a receptive medium, but also that you could in some way use television to communicate with others. And he initially thought about this as a new form of democracy, but gradually came to think of it as a way in which education could happen without the structures of a university, where anybody could program in what they wanted to learn about, and it would come up in the form of pre-recorded lectures. And this idea was fascinating and really powerful from the standpoint that education was to be curiosity-driven, and that it was a matter of trying to nurture that curiosity and to encourage an autodidactic way of learning that would prevent people from going down a given track and becoming a specialized sort of thinker. And that very much was to say that it was a system by which Fuller could produce more people like him in the best sense of the word. So MOOCs, to some extent, do that. But it ends up being that in the case of MOOCs, you seem to end up with an incredibly narrow set of options from the vast potential that might be there, where the vast majority of MOOCs are vocational, and more so all the time, and the completion rate is abysmal. And so these factors taken together suggest that we really need to think about how MOOCs or how other educational systems that might make use of the internet can be truer to a curiosity-driven model, and yet at the same time can carry some sort of the motivational heft that Fuller showed was possible when he would lecture, bringing together tens of thousands of people in some cases, I believe, or at least thousands of people for hours on end. And I think that one way in which to do that is to get out of the top-down way in which MOOCs tend to tell you about something And to open it up, and I've looked at another part of his educational process, which was essentially to get people making things with him, prototyping his ideas, and he would take all the credit. That's another story. But nevertheless, the maker movement seems to echo this in some interesting ways, and yet at the same time, the maker movement has the problem that it tends to be very project-based around kits that have some sort of a specific end in mind. So my thinking is that we can combine these in some sort of a more open-ended way, where MOOCs can be a means by which to physically engage the world through making, and all of the ways in which making is open-ended when there's not an end product in mind, not a kit that you're trying to build, that these two processes taken together, which are both tendencies or trends in our society and can easily be moved in new directions, might bring us into a space where more curiosity-driven education may not be everything that somebody does, but at least becomes a part of everybody's lives.
Well, another question for you is, in your work, you've been able to learn a way of being both rigorous and quite, using a sort of lame word, multidisciplinary. Looking through multiple frames and really staging your thought experiments in many ways at the crossroads of multiple ways of looking at the world, which you take on in a pretty rigorous way. That, to me, leads to this sort of question that I think about in my own life, my own work, the people I know, the people I tend to be attracted to who are kind of edge thinkers or people who move between multiple domains. But it's very hard to figure out how to model that. So in addition to sort of the curiosity-driven making where it's not sort of driven towards a specific end goal or it's not just already constrained by a kit, there's that curiosity of how things work or how we might do things differently. There's a sort of another dimension that at least your work has where you really are thinking of these multiple frames of sometimes very contradictory ways of looking at the world, whether it's religion or, the possible existence of plant intelligence, as well as design issues, scientific issues, art market, cultural, you're really dealing with a lot of different kind of domains. Where did you get that? How does one communicate that willingness? I mean, I think just to say one more thing and then we just have a minute, even in a short way where you got that inspiration from for your work.
I really think, as I said earlier, that it's a Talmudic way of thinking. It's a pursuit of new questions as really the end goal of any answer that is reached. And that way of bootstrapping curiosity, I think, results in a sort of rigor and a need to cross different disciplines and put them all together in new and potentially enlightening ways.
All right. Thank you so much, Jonathan, for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Great. All right, folks, from me to all you, until next week, keep your minds open.